The Dharma, incomparably profound and exquisite, is rarely met with even in hundreds of thousands of millions of kalpas. We now can see it, hear it, accept and hold it. May we realize the true mind of the Tathagata. Today is day 3 of this 7-day session here at Hidden Valley Zen Center in San Marcos, California, in August 2016. It's hard to believe it's already 2016. I was looking at some expiration dates on some things at 2020, and I'm thinking, that's so far away. Then I realized, good heavens, it's only 4 years away. In fact, it's only 3.5, or less than 3.5 years away, actually. Amazing how fast time goes. And that is actually the symbolism of the Han. And as well, the inking bell. When we have that accelerando, it expresses how fast life goes by. The older we get, the faster it goes. The less time we have to do whatever it is we want to do, or do whatever it is we feel we need to do. And since we're here in this Zendo today, there is an underlying assumption that we feel we need to find out who we really are. Return to our true home. And that is something that Zen practice, if it is properly done and sufficiently done with as much faith, doubt, and determination, doubt being really perplexity, not doubt that you can do it, then it can be realized. And it can be realized deeply. And again, as was mentioned before, in the old days when Zen first came to America, well, they went through various stages, one of which was the beat poets felt like if you were really doing Zen, you could do anything you really felt like, anytime you really felt like it, without any restraint. And it led to some rather bizarre behaviors that couldn't really be counted as true Zen expression because they had too much ego image behind them. And then we came to Yasutani Roshi's Dharma successors, a number of who taught in the United States and established the earlier Zen centers. Kepler Roshi, Robert Aitken, Miyazumi Roshi, all had training with Yasutani Roshi, and so they all expressed his expression of Zen practice, which was to come to awakening. And there was an assumption there, a tacit assumption, that coming to awakening was a single thing, that you had your kensho and you were home free. And then as more and more people experienced true Zen practice, it began to get realized, or re-recognized, I should say, because Hakuin certainly expressed it centuries ago when he said that he'd had 19 major kensho experiences and countless minor ones, that a single kensho is not sufficient. It's a start. It's an important start, but it's a start. There's a Tibetan saying that was popularized by Kalu Rinpoche, whose teachings appeared in a book called A Flash of Lightning in a Dark Night. And it was likened to this. You're at midnight without a moon, and you're trying to climb a mountain without really ever having been there before and without knowing the path and without any way really to see clearly the path. And suddenly there's a flash of lightning in that dark night, and the path ahead, at least to a certain degree, is illuminated for those brief seconds. And so now you have a much better sense of the path you need to go on to reach the top of that mountain. And that's what a Kensho experience is, really. And that's why so many more really are called for, because for one thing, a single Kensho is so often a very superficial Kensho. It's enough to cause our teacher to feel that we can work on subsequent koans and to pass us, so to speak, on our initial breakthrough koan. Although traditionally in China, in Joshu's time, for example, people worked on the koan mu for their entire lives. And they would get insights and kenshos and deeper insights and deeper kenshos as time went on, still chewing on that mu koan. And it's like the sasokan, the extended out breath. It can take us deep, it can take us deeper, and it can take us even more deep, and then some. The key, of course, is the persistence, the determination, and to a certain degree, the consistency. If we sit zazen and start to go deep, and then we take a break, we feel like, okay, things are going great, and other things come up in our life, and actually what also comes up without our realizing it is a subtle pulling away from the practice. Because it can feel threatening. And we go deeper and begin to let go more, it can actually feel frightening. Are we going to die? Are we going to disappear? And given human beings' great attachment to life, we didn't come into this world without that. We don't eat and drink and sleep without that underlying motivation to continue existing. And yet when our practice starts to reach a point where thoughts begin to have gaps between them, and so suddenly there's no yada yada in our head for a brief second or even longer, then it can be frightening because we can think, oh my God, I'm going to disappear, I'm going to die. And they don't call it the great death for nothing. Because it is a kind of dying. It's a recognition through letting go, or as part of the process of letting go, of attachment to a self-image. And so many times you've heard how we develop the self-image. And probably every one of you has got some level of experience as children with being chastised or directed or urged to conform, if not by parents, then certainly by society. And certainly when you went to school, there were definite restrictions. When I was going to grade school in Canada, when we were not actively engaged in writing or holding a book open, we were required to sit with our hands folded on top of our desk. And to this day, I find myself with my hands folded when I don't have anything else to do, sitting on an airplane, for example. Conditioning runs deep. And as you also know, we were motivated to conform. There's good reasons for this. It doesn't work very well when we don't fit into society. The world is got its people who don't. The homeless people in Japan, for example, are the ones that didn't fit into that very strict society. At the same time, it's rather interesting because their encampments are quite neat and clean. They live in their cardboard boxes, but their shoes are neatly placed outside the cardboard box. Some amount of conditioning has maintained, even though they don't fit. In America, so many of our homeless are either people who were in mental institutions or have some mental problems that prevents them from fitting neatly and comfortably into society, or from society neatly and comfortably accepting them, as well as now so many of our returning military young people who find that after their intense and painful and terrifying experiences, not to mention their wounds, their physical wounds from being in war zones, have kept them from feeling any longer comfortable in normal society. So we have this very strong incentive to conform, and that brings about a certain amount of awareness of our surroundings in terms of being careful to obey the rules, so to speak, unless we have a particular self-identity that involves, like, a certain political potential president who feels that he seems to feel, at least, that he can buck the rules. But most of us are very invested in keeping the rules and fitting in to society. And so that produces a way of living, an awareness in living, that causes us to forget who we really are and to lose connection with it. Zazen is a practice that brings us back closer and closer to that innate connection, that experiencing of who we really are. And as a result, it requires us, if we're to really do it, to step out of that self-image, not to maintain it so carefully, not to react when it gets bumped into, but rather to explore the experience of anger rising, of embarrassment rising, in the interest of finding out who we really are. I'd like to share with you today at least one account of some ongoing awakening experiences by a couple of Westerners who were in touch with Charles Luk. Charles Luk was Luk Kuan Yew, who was a Chinese gentleman born in what used to be called Canton, China, and eventually went to live in Hong Kong. He was a student of one of the greatest contemporary Zen masters in China. I guess I should say Chan masters, because that's how it's pronounced more or less in Chinese. Siyun. Siyun was an amazing human being who, as a young man, actually ran away from home when his parents tried to marry him off to a couple of young women. Obviously, they were well off, or they wouldn't have been able to afford two wives for him. And he went off and became a monk and dedicated his life to coming to deep awakening and eventually to teach it. And Charles Luk was, at the time, his only successor. There's a more contemporary Chan master, a relatively young man. I think he's maybe in his very early 40s at this point, and speaks excellent English. I don't recall his name exactly, but a number of Westerners have met him. He has been the abbot of Joshu's temple, and he carries along he carries on the lineage of Su Yun in modern China, how he managed to escape the Cultural Revolution, I'm not quite sure, although he was quite young at the time, if he was not even born, maybe. Anyway, Su Yun lived to be, by official records, 119 years old. And that despite a vicious beating by the Red Guards in the early 1950s, who left him for dead, but he survived for another year after that. In China, they keep very precise records and have for millennia. I grew up with a Chinese godfather, and one day he showed my mother his family, the equivalent for us of a family Bible, except that I don't think there was any spiritual teaching in it. It was family records, all bound in a book, and it traced his family back way into the Song Dynasty, just several centuries ago. So it's very clear that Su Yun did live to be 119. So Charles Luk himself was an awakened master who chose to remain a layperson. And he did a lot of translations into English at the request of Su Yun, including one called The Transmission of the Mind Outside the Teaching, the basic teachings of the Chinese Zen masters. And it covers, along with the record keeping, the Chinese kept records of the Zen masters and their sayings and doings. And there's a whole long collection that has only partly been translated into English about the teaching lives, and when enough is known, also about the actual lives of the Chinese Zen masters going way, 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 way back. And that's part of what is expressed in this book, translated in this book. The teachers in the lineage of the sixth patriarch. But I'd like to read to you something from the foreword. Several somethings. The present volume contains biographies and teachings of masters of the first, second, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth generation of the Nanyo lineage of Dharma descendants of the sixth patriarch, Huineng, with explanations and annotations to make the text clear to the average reader. And again, this is a book because Charles Luk had done deep practice. It's one that one can trust his translations. There were, in the early days of translations of Buddhist texts, a lot of translations, but there were a number of translations of Buddhist texts done by Britishers who quaintly couched it all in Christian language. They were not practitioners themselves, they were translators. And it's much better if you have a choice and you're searching for some inspiration in terms of Buddhist teachings to check out who's doing the translation, or with more contemporary works, who's doing the actual writing of the book, because it makes a big difference what level of practice they have reached. Otherwise, you can be led astray. They can be very convincing and yet not know what they're talking about. It continues, some of our readers have experienced a major awakening. In Japanese, that's called Satori. In Chinese, it's called Wu. So he translated the Vimalakirti Nirdesa Sutra in order to help give those people guidance. And here is a letter from an English practitioner about his follow-up experiences post-Satori. And this comes with a warning. As some of you already know, in my earlier years of practice at the Rochester Zen Center, I clung to the awakening stories of the masters that Kepler-Roshi had included in that book, The Three Pillars of Zen, because they gave me hope and inspired me to practice. Until one day, I realized in a sesshin that I was only half doing my practice. The other half of my mind was set on weighing and measuring that practice as compared to the stories in the Enlightenment chapter of the Three Pillars of Zen. And so I quit reading that book, and I actually quit reading all books for a while because it was too easy to fill my head with ideas that I only had to try to sink beneath in the practice. The practice was difficult enough for me in those days that anything I could do to make it easier, I was willing to do, and that included not reading. And, you know, Kepler-Roshi used to say, the only book to read if you're doing Zen practice is the one that will bring you to the cushion. We can fill our heads with all kinds of ideas about Zen practice, about awakening, about you name it, and think that we're doing Zen practice. But we're not. We're just filling our head with ideas and thoughts and words. The only real practice is there on the cushion or in activity, as Hakuin has expressed, which is why we were willing to go ahead and hold this short wedding service during the exercise period today at Sesshin, where it's optional. You can come and be part of the wedding if you want to, part of the audience, I should say, or you can go elsewhere and do your exercise. It's up to you, and neither one is better or worse than the other. Coming to the wedding offers a person a chance to do that practice in the midst of activity, to maintain your focus on the present moment totally, and keeping that breath going when you find yourself straying. And that is to say, if you are finding your mind wandering as you're being totally present with the experience of the moment, whether it's in the wedding or out doing your exercise, it's time to stop and do a single out-breath, fully, completely, totally experienced, all the way to the end, as if there was nothing else in the universe and it was your last breath. And then you return to whatever it is you're doing. As for being present, that means being present. That means whatever you're doing, whether it's listening and watching at the wedding or out and about doing your exercise, means just doing that. Just doing that. Not doing that with a mind that's thinking about tomorrow or afterwards or, oh, how nice it is, or, gee, the sun is really nice and warm today. Oh, maybe I should get in the shade to do this exercise. Let it all go. And if you're working on a koan, it's nothing but the yearning to comprehend the koan. And if you're in the wedding or outside doing exercise or over in the kanondo doing exercise, the same thing. Let that yearning do the exercise. Let that yearning fill your being as you're witnessing the wedding. Don't try to separate the two. So here's the follow-up letter from the Englishman who had a Kensho. It's a long time since I last wrote you, but each time I open your books, we are in communication, and I feel a sense of gratitude flow through my being. Now I wish to thank you for your translation of the Vimalakirti Sutra, which you have so kindly been posting to me as you completed it. How wondrous it is to read with the eye what the being has experienced, to understand in thought what the intuition knows. The water is delicious and cool as one drinks, but the smile on the face of the drinker is understood. May the gratitude of this drinker be confirmation to you in your labors that such work carries consequences for the benefit of human beings that cannot be estimated in mere words. The warning given by the hermit on Panchan to Hanshan when he told of his first experience of dropping his mind and body in the ocean of non-duality has been constantly with me. Do not cling to even this, quote, manifestation of the aggregates, close quote. So I shall attempt to do what we both know cannot be done, and in a few words tell you what the situation is from where at this moment I stand. A year ago I went into a retreat, or sesshin, with a group of young people, and for 14 days we kept up meditation. I passed through the various stages that are now familiar to me, and which I now can understand by reference to your books. One night my body and mind dropped away, as happened before. There was the same sense of a burst of light into which the whole cosmos dissolved, and with it an incredible sense of bliss. This was the dropping of the ego. A warning here. Blissful moments can occur in our practice, some of which have nothing to do with awakening. They can also occur as part of an experience of Kensho. And we are incredibly tempted to stay there and simply enjoy that blissful mind state. That is getting caught in a cave of dead sitting. That is neither fish nor fowl. You're stuck. You're not truly awakened because you haven't completed the process. So one night my body and mind dropped away as happened before. There was the same burst of light into which the whole cosmos dissolved, and with it the incredible sense of bliss. This was the dropping of the ego. But the next phase was different from my previous experience. There was a sense of interweaving of the atoms of the cosmos with the energy that seemed to be the consciousness that was aware of it. This was like being a galaxy that seemed to be dissolving into pure energy that was itself a pulse beat in the total void. At this last point, consciousness itself dissolved in oneness. How long I remained sitting in meditation, I do not know, because I was left alone in the room. But the return of consciousness, self-consciousness, was quicker, I think, than the previous time. There was also the indescribable feeling of weightlessness, which I had before, which again lasted a day or so. But the most obvious difference was the feeling that though I could say that I was conscious of myself as being, this sense was no longer located in this or any body. It was as if the whole world was conscious, was a living, moving body of energy, which was also at the heart quite still and serene. My mind seemed quite empty of any thought except that it seemed to be able to function. But it was simply reflecting what was around and objective without any subjective choice or selection or attachment. It was certainly like having no head at all. With this, there was a return of the heightened vision that I had before. By the way, having no head at all, there is a man who had that much of an awakening experience and actually wrote a book about it called On Having No Head. And Flora Courtois, who had a much more thorough, deep, awakening experience, met him at one point, and it was clear to her, as it is to a reader who's been through it themselves, that he had not completed the process of coming to awakening. It's a very complex process, and to have a first hit of a sense of disappearance of self or a sense of oneness is not the whole experience. And this is a warning. With this, there was a return of the heightened vision that I had before. Everything one looked at seemed not only as if seen that moment for the first time, but also was brighter, more luminous, as if glowing. The whole world was radiant. The mind that experienced this was also the thing that was experienced. You note that he didn't say what I experienced. Because at that moment there was no I in the picture. The complete knowing that is the experience. Not one word can be said that is not one word too much. Oh, my friend, I know why the wise ones of old simply laughed or held up a flower. It's all there like the wind through the trees and the sweet, cool water when we are hot. Show me your mind and the universe is void. For a short while, I also could see auras of light around those around me. These would change with their moods and thoughts, and at times it was as if I were their bodies, felt that I was them and looking out from their eyes. But this soon passed. The light is the darkness, and the darkness is the light. Consciousness without objects to be conscious of, not even consciousness of consciousness, for there is not even that space for duality to enter. And then, a year after that, another letter. It must be a year since I last wrote to you, and many times I felt that I should, but then I think of your work and how busy you must be, so that I do not like to intrude on your valuable time. My dear friend, how are you keeping in health? I do trust that all has gone well with you and your work this past year. My thoughts turn often to you, for you are one of the few people with whom I know I can communicate at those reaches of experience that lie at the threshold of intuition. One does not meet with such friends often. I do not think that I thanked you for your last letter, which I now do. In it, you ask that I should forgive you for publishing a few passages from my letters without asking my permission. My friend, of course you must use anything that I write to you as you see fit. As you say, if the Buddha tells us to sacrifice our bodies, minds, flesh, bones, and marrow, etc., for the Dharma, what are my few words? Use anything I write to you if it will be of use. It was that I felt that my experience could not really be of interest or value to anyone else. But I do realize why you included it now, as it demonstrated that such experiences are not either peculiar to the East or sometimes no longer possible in this sad age of yours. In my practice now, I'm at a stage where, after dropping body and mind and being in a state of luminosity where all phenomenal multiplicity is dropped into the still bliss of the One, to stop in this state or to think it is the ultimate I realize is wrong. It is nothing extraordinary in itself, though its bliss is very seductive. Be warned here, everyone. Be warned. There are many times in our practice when unique experiences that seem quite wondrous can come up. that actually are hindrances in the way. They're what we would call makyo, devilish phenomena, that the mind engages in almost as if to prevent ourselves from letting go and seeing through this thought mind. This is only the joy characteristic of self with a capital S, as Master Hanshan says. Attainment is instant and complete and all-embracing, so it is also no attainment and nothing is attained, for there has never been any departure from that which is. Practice must follow each in and out breath, for the seeds of old age habits are sown deep and the weeding will never end till the bodhisattva's vow is realized. This is the long maturation. We can have a very, very deep awakening, as people have had in the past. And if initially we're in that mind state of nothing attached, and then the old habit patterns come rolling in. But know that when they come rolling in, they're not as strong as they were before we saw through them. At the same time, one of the things that awakening can do is lessen in the inhibitions. And so we're more likely to zing one way or another out and beyond. All of this is part of the advanced work, the long maturation, to bring what we have realized in that awakening experience to life, so that we're not caught by our old habit patterns, so that we become free of them. And each time an old habit pattern comes up and we choose not to indulge in it, it weakens that synaptic connection in our brain and makes it even easier the next time. This is, as one dear friend of mine said, kalpa work. But what joy to be on a path where we can do it, where we can let go our delusive habit patterns that cause us to unwittingly contribute more grief and suffering to the world and to ourselves. Little by little, letting it go. And of course, it's essential to keep on practicing and not to assume that even the depth of awakening this man has had is sufficient. We keep practicing. Every single one of you here has what it takes to come to profound awakening. Right now, we have 4 days left in our sesshin. A little bit more than 4 days, but not much more than 4 days. Each of you has been doing zazen during these days, gradually going a little bit deeper, gradually becoming more focused. And because of that, it's easier, with a level of commitment to do so, to take it even deeper. And then to take it even deeper yet. And then to take it even deeper yet. And then who knows what can happen in terms of liberation. As the Han expresses, and the Yingqin Bell as well, with these accelerandos, time flashes by more and more quickly the older we get. And we never know for sure how much time we're going to have. during the last session my Dharma sister Sunyana gave in Costa Rica. A longtime member. He was only in his early 60s. Who'd been there for at least 30 years. Dedicated practitioner. Had a sudden heart attack and died on the last day of session. My deepest hope is when that moment comes for us, whether it's in or out of session, that we are so free, that we can leave without a trace. And then if next life will be even more free and even further along the bodhisattva path. And of course, as budding bodhisattvas, our commitment in practice is to come to awakening for the benefit of all beings. To work our butts off. To go as deep as we can while we have this lifetime of connection with it, because we don't know in what lifetime after this we'll have a chance to encounter the Dharma again. This is considered the Dharma ending age. And certainly, the world is in turmoil, which is considered to be part of that. How will it be when the light of your eyes is falling? Will you be like the crab with its 6 arms and 7 legs, struggling to get out of the boiling water? Or will you be free, truly, profoundly free? Thank you for listening. We'll stop now and recite the 4 vows.